This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. When Alex Kotlowitz's book, There Are No Children Here, first came out in 1992, the country was facing unprecedented violence. Homicides in the nation's largest cities were at an all-time high, triggered by gangs and a drug trade that dominated many of the country's poorest neighborhoods. His book was set in the Henry Horner Homes, a public housing project on the west side of Chicago.
But much has changed over the last decades. The Henry Horner Homes, as well as many other public housing projects in Chicago, were torn down. The gangs that once ruled these areas were similarly demolished, as gang leaders were jailed with hefty sentences. Violence decreased, but it didn't vanish.
Kotlowitz's newest book is called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. It tells 14 stories about loss, family, and survival in a city that continues to be racked by gun violence. Kotlowitz will be in Milwaukee this Wednesday for an event at Boswell Book Company, but he joined us by phone beforehand. Alex, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, I have to say, writing questions for this interview was really difficult. It's hard to find a place to begin, in part because I don't think anyone can read this book and not feel like these conversations are a little insufficient, right? Insufficient in some way. But I'd like to start here. Why did you write this book? Why right now?
In some ways, this book is kind of a bookend to my first book, There Are No Children Here, which came out some 28 years ago. And one of the things that knocked me off balance when I was working on that book was the just pervasiveness of the violence in the community I was writing about. You know, I was following two young boys in a public housing complex. And I have been really distressed and sobered by the stubborn persistence of the violence. And my feeling over the years is that we've completely underestimated the impact of the violence on the spirit of both individuals and the spirit of community. And that's what I wanted to try to get at in this book and these very intimate stories.
You know, one of the things the book talks about is PTSD. And it's one of those things that you go, it's not quite the right word because it's never post.
Right. You know, there's a conversation among social workers who work in these communities, and I certainly saw it in the people that I spent time with. You know, they have a lot of the same symptoms that combat veterans had returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they're easy to anger, they have trouble concentrating, they're self-medicating by smoking marijuana or drinking, trouble sleeping, just anxious all the time. But as you suggest, while they have the same symptoms of those who've experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, there's nothing post about it because they experience the violence, they lose a loved one, they're a witness to an act of brutality, and yet there's no safety, there's no place of respite. They are still looking over their shoulder for what's going to happen next. And so social workers have this informal term in these communities, it's what they call complex loss, the idea that you may lose someone close to you, but then have to reckon with what lies ahead.
There's so many different coping mechanisms that are on display in this book, and I'd like to get back to that, but to kind of go back in Chicago's history, because we tend to talk about violence in Chicago as though it's still kind of the 1990s, as though it has these mechanisms that are in some ways no longer there. So how have things changed in Chicago since you wrote There Are No Children Here?
Sure. Well, the two most notable things that have changed is as bad as the violence is now, and it is really bad, it was actually worse some 28 years ago. Though I will say the numbers in the past couple of years have approached the numbers of the 1990s again, which has been really disturbing and unsettling. But the other part that's changed considerably is back in the early 90s, the gangs were organized around the drug trade. And so the violence was much more directed. It was usually over controlling their turf or their terrain. And in the late 1990s, the law enforcement agencies went after the heads of the snake. They went and arrested many of the gang leaders in the city, and as a result, the gangs began to fall apart. And now, you know, the police estimate there are now 600 to 800 different cliques or crews around the city organized block by block. They're not organized around the drug trade. The violence feels more arbitrary. It feels more petty, that somebody's been disrespected in some manner, and it feels much more unpredictable.
You mentioned cliques, of course, and in the book you speak with someone who was the head of a gang in Chicago, and something that he talks about is exactly what you mentioned, how arbitrary the violence has become. When you're talking about these cliques, it seems as though everyone in the book is part of something, that it's kind of unavoidable.
Well, it's hard if you're young, especially a young man growing up in these communities, just by the nature of where you live, not to belong to one of these organizations. And I think one of the things that was clear to me, and you see it in some of the stories in the book, is that often when the newspapers or the police report on an act of violence, the first thing that they describe about the victim is the fact that they were a gang member, as if that somehow is what defines them. And as a result, people, loved ones, are, you know, their immediate stance in the wake of losing someone is to defend them, because there's this kind of notion out there, I think, that what goes around comes around.
One of the things the book really does is it does humanize people. You know, you read headlines, especially if you're in the city of Chicago or if you're in a city like Milwaukee, honestly, and it is very matter of fact. This person was shot. It was at this corner, and this is their criminal record. But there is so much more to that person. And the interesting part of it is, of your book, is that you not only humanize the victims, but you also humanize the perpetrators.
What I wanted to do in this book, I was looking for, you know, the book is, it takes place over the course of this one summer. It's a collection of 14 stories. Some of them course through the summer, some are self-contained. And I was looking for stories that upended my thinking, that challenged my own sort of presuppositions and assumptions. And what I wanted to write, I wanted, you know, the kind of centripetal force of storytelling is empathy, this idea of trying to imagine yourself as others. And I wanted to try to write this book without judging, but really trying to understand. So the stories really vary. And as you mentioned, one of the stories is about a gentleman who, at the age of 18, in an act of vengeance, one of his friends has been shot and paralyzed, goes out and kills a rival gang member, and he ends up serving 14 years in prison. And Eddie Bocanegra, his story is really a story about trying to forgive yourself for what you've done. And Eddie, as an adult, has devoted every minute of his life to trying to undo some of the damage that he helped cause when he was younger. He's, you know, working in violence prevention. He's mentoring young people. I mean, just an extraordinary individual. But the story itself is Eddie's still trying to find a way to forgive himself for what he had done.
One of the stories that stuck out to me was the mother of a man who was shot by another man in a situation that it seemed like no one really came in with good mm-hmm. intentions.
Right.
And it really highlighted how people can end up really on either side of that
right.
equation.
Right. No, the lines are often blurred. I mean, the story you talk about is a story of this extraordinary woman, Lisa Daniels, a single mom. Her older son is an engineering student at University of Illinois, and her younger son, Darren, he wanders, he strays, he gets involved in dealing drugs. Lisa does everything she can to hold him close. And then one day he goes to buy some drugs, a small amount of marijuana. It appears that he had all intentions of robbing the drug dealer, and that the drug dealer may have had all intentions of robbing him. And a shootout erupts, and Darren is killed. And so two things happen. One is that the local newspaper runs a story about Darren's death, and all it talks about is his criminal record. He had spent some time in prison. And Lisa, his mother, she wasn't in denial. She knew exactly her son's history. She knew what her son had done, but she knew there was so much more to Darren. And so she made it a point to letting people know that her son was a much richer, complicated human being than the authorities would lead you to believe. And in fact, she got on her license plate, on the frame of her license plate, it reads, "I had a son, his name was Darren." But the other remarkable thing about Lisa is, you know, she assumes that his the person who killed him is going to go to way prison for a long time. It seems like a kind of open and shut case. But as it turns out, the witness to the shooting had a criminal record and made for a suspect witness. And so the state's attorney decides that they want to offer a plea deal. And Lisa says, okay, but I have one request, and I want to give a victim impact statement at the sentencing. And usually victim impact statements are about the impact the death of the loved one has had on you and your family. And so Lisa gets up in the courtroom, and she talks a little bit about that. But then she gives this remarkable talk where she asks for leniency, where she forgives the person who shot her son. And in fact, to this day, she's got a correspondence with the young man who's now serving time in prison.
Her story is so remarkable, I think in part because many of us, although we want to believe we would be like her, I think many of us know that maybe we couldn't.
It is really hard, and I think to be fair, and I really want to be careful about this, and Lisa knows this, is that there are instances where forgiveness is really, really hard, if not impossible, when there's no sense of remorse on the part of the individual who had done the shooting. But go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, no problem. But one of the things I was about to ask is there are a lot of different coping mechanisms, but also just responses to the violence that people mm-hmm. see, that they experience. What are some of the ways that people deal with this onslaught of violence?
You know, the thing for me that was notable among most of the people I spent time with is they hold on to their feelings and their experiences really tightly. Not only are they not encouraged from talking about it, but sometimes discouraged out of fear that if they do, they'll be held culpable for the crime. And so for many of the people I spent time with, it was the first time they spoke about their loss, about what they were going through. I mean, there's this kind of utter sense of loneliness. And that, you know, that grief, that trauma can take a toll on individuals. You know, people look for solace in all different manners and ways. You know, many of the mothers who grieve in Chicago, they form support groups amongst each other. After a shooting in the city, the shrines arise, you know, flowers and balloons, you know, and in the summer, they're kind of, you can find them virtually everywhere. So people have all these different ways of managing. And I think, you know, the truth of the matter is, I think by telling stories is what, there's a great line in Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, where he writes, you know, it's this novel about, loosely based on his experience in Vietnam, where he writes, you know, this much is true, stories can save us. And I think what O'Brien was saying is that if we can tell our stories, if we can share our stories, that's what ultimately will connect us, will make us feel less alone.
Well, and with that thought, you know, these stories are in some ways very uniquely Chicago. But you didn't title the book A Chicago Summer, you titled it An American Summer. And of course, these stories are very familiar here in Milwaukee. You know, what are the elements of these stories that are right. universal and really speak to the violence that we're seeing throughout the country?
Right. Well, I titled it that way for two reasons. One is that, you know, you're right. The book takes place in Chicago. It just as easily could have taken place in Milwaukee and in Detroit and Philadelphia, Baltimore. I mean, there's so many cities that are experiencing this. But moreover, you know, a country that's been racked by gun violence. And what's notable to me is that in the wake of the tragic shootings in Newtown and then Parkland, we asked all the right questions. You know, well, what brought this young man to do what he did? How do these individuals in this community emerge with all that's bearing down on them? We don't ask those questions in places like Chicago or Milwaukee or Detroit or Baltimore. And we need to start asking those questions.
What do you hope people take away from this book? People who might not know anything about the city of Chicago, who may have a lot of misconceptions about what gun violence looks like.
Yeah. And again, I don't see this book as a book about Chicago. I feel like it's really a book about the kind of soul of our country. And what I want people to come to understand is that in some ways, the book is a kind of rallying cry that we need to begin really sort of figuring out what we can do. And I think the one commonality you'll see in all the neighborhoods in Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Baltimore, where the violence is so pervasive, is that these are communities that are deeply distressed. And in some ways, this seems so self-evident, I even hesitate to say it aloud, but we need to find ways to rebuild and refortify community. And so given how self-evident it is, the question I ask is, where's everyone been? You know, for me, I tell stories, my ambitions are reasonably modest, is I tell stories to introduce readers to communities they otherwise wouldn't venture to introduce them to people they otherwise wouldn't meet. And my hope is that when you put down this book, that you'll look at yourself and the world just a little bit differently.
I think that's a very modest hope there, and something that I don't think anyone could pick up this book and not think differently.
Well, thanks. Thanks.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alex Kotlowitz is a journalist and the author of An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. He'll join Lake Effect's Joy Powers in conversation Wednesday night at Boswell Book Company, and there's more information at wuwm.com.